Hey, welcome to the CEO Anonymous podcast with Pradeep Sangha, a captivating platform designed for CEOs, business owners, and entrepreneurs like you. Our goal is to provide insightful answers to your burning business or personal performance questions. So join our panel of experts as they share their powerful wisdom and expertise. We greatly appreciate your participation. And to submit your questions, simply go to askpradeep.com. Now let's get to the show and delve into the heart of today's question. So today we have the pleasure of answering this question. How does a CEO get investors on board with their vision and actually get them to invest their money into the company? And who better to share that insight with us than Silvio? He's the founder and CEO of Hopper. I'm going to let him talk about, you know, his background, where he's from. Very fascinating. Silvio, you and I got a chance to connect through my brother, and you're local here. You're in Canada, you're in Hamilton. I'm 20 minutes away from you, and you're doing some pretty fabulous things here. So welcome. First of all, welcome, Silvio. Appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you. Thank you, Pradeep. Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, I'm excited about this conversation. I'm excited about hearing where your company is now, because since we last chatted, there seems to be some pretty good progress. And then we'll get into this question here. You know, how does the CEO get people on board and get them to invest? Because you guys got people to invest. But before we get into that, can you give the people out there a sense of your background, who you are, where you come from, and Hopper? Like, what is this company?
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, so I'm from Brazil. Let's start with that. So I grew in Brazil, born and raised in Brazil. My background is in electrical engineering. I did my undergrad back there. And so my history is that, like, I grew up in a very, like, a poor family. So motorcycle has always been the only means of transportation for, like, almost my whole life. I was able to see a lot of the challenge that people faced using motorcycles in developing countries, which, by the way, is a very different use case that we have here in North America, right? So there is, like, the only means of transportation for a lot of people, the main source of income, everything is done by motorcycles.
So can I just jump in there? I don't mean to interrupt, but I think you're right, because when I was in India, I noticed that motorcycles are a necessity in a third world country, where in North America, or particularly U.S. and Canada, I think it's more of a recreational thing. Is that pretty much it?
Exactly. Yeah. In countries like Latin America, they're a necessity. Exactly that. So, like, delivery of goods, a lot of them done by motorcycles. Commuting, motorcycles. Salesforce, a lot of them use motorcycle for that. So we used to say that Brazil moves on two wheels, because a lot of the goods, they are done by motorcycles. And this is, like, the quickest way to move around. This is the most economical way to move around. So it's a very different scenario. It's not like not only recreational, which, by the way, it also is for a lot of people, but motorcycles are the main source of income for a lot of families. And it's very different, right? Because when you see the motorcycles here in North America, usually they have a little bit more safety. You can find, like, some with ABS, even though they're not mandatory, a little bit more power. But the entry-level bikes in Brazil that represents 97% of the market, they have, like, zero safety features. So it's, like, the bare minimum. A lot of them, they get stolen, which is problematic if you use them as your only means of transportation and source of income, right? So, like, states like São Paulo last year, there was, like, 40,000 stolen in just one region of Brazil. So it's, like, a lot of these problems. And this is how I grew up, right? Using motorcycles, being involved in accidents that could be avoided with, like, a very basic safety features. The fear of getting my bike stolen when I would just like stop and grab a coffee, need to change to like a pole or something. And even though like a, you would never know like if it would be there. And this is what had to be changed, right? On top of that, there's like a huge issue with emissions, right? So pollution for motorcycles. Interesting, it's like five to 10 times more than a passenger vehicle. Wow. Because the exhaust system is basically straight pipe. In a car, you have a very sophisticated system, right? So that was the motivation to start the company. And I didn't tell yet what we do, right? But so Alper is a technology company first, before even being like an electric motorcycle. So what we've done with Alper is build and design an electric motorcycle that can bring premium, affordable technology. So make like a safety features affordable, being like sustainable by being electric, advanced like anti-theft features. So all this in a package that we can make it affordable enough that regular people can buy. So this is the main goal with the company, the main mission, is to bring a product that is significantly better than anything on the market right now, and improve the quality of life of people that needs to use more cycle, right? So the journey has been like very long. So I did my undergrad in Brazil. I've been working in the auto industry for the past 15 years or so. Then I moved to Canada in 2017 to do my PhD. And then I was like heavily involved with electrification and electric vehicles and within the industry. And I personally came to Canada to found Alper. So in Brazil, it's hard. Like people, they are not exposed to electric vehicles. There's not many resources there. And to build a company like the one that we are building is basically impossible if you don't have a very good understanding and the connections with people in the industry, right? So that was the main motivation moving to Canada.
So just curious. So, you know, one of the first things when I heard about your a company was, aren't there already electric motorcycles out there?
Oh yeah, there are several. So there are several other electric motorcycles, and there are several other electric motorcycles that fails. So for the first question is like, this is the major concern for a lot of investors, right? Why from like 90% of all the electric motorcycles that comes to the market, you guys are the ones that are going to succeed, right? And the main reason that they fail, they fail for several reasons. Lack of innovation is one of the main ones. So building an electric motorcycle is not only replacing a gas engine by an electric motor and a gas tank by a battery pack, right? So if you do this way, you're not much better than a gas bike. It's not to say that you're even worse, right? Because now you need to worry about charging, like range and everything else. And performance, gas bikes has never, nobody had complained about the performance of the gas bikes, right? Because the problem with performance of gas bikes, how can you keep the front wheel on the ground? There has never been like a power issue. So lack of innovation, that's one of the reasons why these companies fail. Because if you just like make an electric, convert a gas bike to electric, basically, you're not doing better than the rest, right? And to compete with gas motorcycles, you need to be several times better. We've seen this over and over now with EVs, right? You see Tesla outperforms any gas car with a lot of technology. Then you see Rivian and Lucid and all these startups. It's hard to compare with a gas car, right? The amount of value that they can bring to the user.
Yep. I think one of the things, just on that note, you know, I'm in the market of getting a new truck potentially. And so mm-hmm. I have a 2015. I'm looking for the new GMC EV Denali that's coming out, but it's mm-hmm. still, it keeps getting postponed. But I have this question in the back of my head, you know, the problems with the technology right? They're still out there, you know, especially in the cold, for example, being in Canada, that's still something that's on the top of my head. What's the point of having a pickup truck if it's not going to work properly in the middle of winter? And then I'm always wondering, because the Canadian government has talked about being carbon, let's just say neutral or whatever it is, by 2030. It's 2024 right now, which gives me another 6 years. So do I just still get a gas vehicle or some kind of a hybrid until 2030 and then switch over when the technology is mature? That's what's going through my mind with in cars, which have been around for a while, right? The EV market for cars has been around. So those are, just as a consumer, one of the things that I'm constantly thinking about.
Yeah, and it's like a very application dependent, right? So if you own a truck, for example, you do a lot of towing, it makes no sense to be EV. And the same goes for motorcycles, right? If you go for like a high performance motorcycle, like there's no point of being an electric motorcycle, right? Because like if you get like a high performance electric motorcycle, now you have a very high weight. The performance is not great. The handling is bad. Range is terrible because aerodynamics for motorcycle, they're pretty bad compared to cars. So it's all dependent on the application, right? The truck is the same thing, right? If you need to do a lot of towing, EV, probably right now, not the best solution. And we identified that as well with the industry, right? So we have no desire make like a cruiser motorcycle or like a high-performance electric motorcycle. And we hear questions this a lot. Why don't you guys make like a high-performance electric motorcycle like Tesla did with the Roadster? And it's like, because it makes no sense, to be fair. It's very dependent on application, actually. And you're completely right. So if you do like a city commuting, if a car, and cars, they have a pretty good aerodynamics and like a weight ratio as well. So this, for cars, very good market. Trucks, depend on your application. Motorcycles, city commuting, best use. Cruiser, high performance, not a good fit. And I don't see that like the gas vehicles, they will go away anytime soon. That will be impossible, by the way. Like we need to improve the grid and distribution and generation. Like there's a lot to be improved. We're still like in a transition stage, right? In the industry.
So I want to get your insight here, because you just recently now, because this question is something that people are interested in, and you have just recently raised some money for your company. So you were successfully able to raise it. Now you're able to, maybe you can give us some background in terms of how long did it take you, but maybe more around this question that CEOs have out there. How did you get people on board with your vision, and how did you actually get them to open up their wallets and invest in your company?
Yeah, this is not an easy question, I have to say. Especially in these times, like with the economy, pretty tough. And when it comes to company like ours, that's like a hardware company or an EV, that we need to raise a lot of capital, moving forward. And in a market that's different than North America, it becomes hard, right? So even to explain to investors, for example, to tell an investor that there's like a one company in Brazil, like just one company, that they own 1.1 million motorcycles for delivery, it's hard. When you say like, okay, in Canada last year was like 60,000 motorcycles sold, and in Brazil was 1.6 million, it's hard even to show like the size, right? Wow. And when it comes to the company itself, hard tech, from a lot of people that I'm talking with, they say like it's hard to raise money because the initial investment of capital is high, right? If you don't build everything yourself. So I think that the major question that comes to first, like, how can you convince people, right? How can you show your vision? I think it's the first thing is to remove the doubt, right? Like, be very clear, like, why all these companies are failing? Why 95% of all these startups that are bringing electric motorcycles, they fail, right? What are they doing wrong? What are the lessons that you learn with that? What are the challenges that we'll face moving forward? and then show like a little bit more like on the market and demand and how the market is moving in the window, the time that you have that this window is open, right? I think that showing like right away, removing the doubt, and try to do like a bottom up expectation of how you go to the market. Don't say like, okay, this is like a $270 billion market. If we get 1% of the market, we are like good. This is not the way. It needs to be very specific as well. Like, what is the market that you're going? What is the segment of the market? What are the margins? So a lot of the things that, at least from the conversation with investors, to be like as transparent as possible, and try to remove the doubt, because that was the main concern for us, at least, is like why you guys are different, why you're doing is better, how you get a better chance in the market, right? So how you're going to manufacture, how you're going to scale, even though these are things for the later stage, this is a big concern, right? Anything related to hardware. Software, I think it's a might be a little bit different. We are an interplay of actually hardware and software. So the hardware, we developed the hardware to be a platform for our software. So we need both instead of like just one side.
I just want to pause there for a second. We're going to get into this because there's a couple things that stand out for me. You're talking about removing doubt, which I think is important because I think that's very prominent, and being transparent, because I think a lot of people, when they go out to raise money, it becomes more of a sales pitch. And investors, they can pick up on this, especially seasoned investors. They can pick up on, you know, those little things, those problems that could potentially be there. But if you bring those up at the beginning, they have a lot more trust. So I appreciate that, because I think that becomes so much easier. And this is something that changed my perspective. Someone who is very good in sales once said, you know what, your job isn't to sell something. Your job is to inform, educate the person, and do it in an effective manner so they know the pros and cons and allow them to make the decision and allow them to make an educated decision. And when I took a look at that, I was like, okay, you know, that's a different take. That's a different approach. I can get on board with that, and I can do that all day long. But I've seen your motorcycle. I've seen what your company is about. Can you just briefly, and we're gonna get away from this question, mm-hmm. but I want to just see, I don't think people listening can appreciate some of the stuff that your motorcycle, that your technology does. Can you just share just maybe three or four or five things that your motorbike does or the technology does from that's different than a traditional motorcycle?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So there are like a few things, right? So first, I think that it's good to start with the motivation why we did everything ourselves, right? And I think that this, like, for us to scale is important as well. And then I will move to the details of what we do. But for us, design and develop the whole technology is first to allow us to do a lot of the things that we want to do, and also be as supplier independent as possible. So to de-risk as possible, as much as possible. So for example, on the safety side, because this is like the basis of the company, right? We started with let's make the safest motorcycle we can make while keeping affordable. So ABS, traction control, stability control, anti-wheelie, all this haptic feedback for navigation, so you don't need to look to the screen and you keep looking to the road. So all these things for us, they are based on software, not hardware. So this is how we can reduce the cost of our motorcycle. Instead of putting together a bunch of electronics, we centralize everything. It's the first one in the industry to do that. This also allows us to do, for example, I mentioned the motorcycles being stolen, right? Which is a huge, if you imagine for the government, the amount of money that needs to go there to try to recover these bikes and police and everything else. So one region, 40,000 motorcycles stolen. And imagine that it's almost all the motorcycles sold in Canada last year.
Yep.
So for us to do a proper anti-theft solution, all the main components, they need to talk with each other. So they all share an encrypted key that is encrypted back to the original owner. which means that the parts, they have no value on the black market. So we discourage the motorcycle from being stolen. This is our approach.
I'm going to jump in there because that to me was a huge fascinating part. So, and again, I'm naive to many of the things out there in life and not realizing, okay, it's similar to a vehicle where people will steal it, strip the parts and sell the parts. What I'm gathering, correct me if I'm wrong here, is someone could take the motorcycle, strip the parts, but they're not going to be worth anything because the software has encrypted it.
Exactly. So like we don't say that's unstealable, right? Because like we can't do that. But what we want to do is discourage. So all the main components of the bike, they have this encrypted key that's encrypted back to you. So let's say the motorcycle was stolen. You say the motorcycle was stolen. First, you can remote lock and track the bike because we have GPS and connectivity and everything else. But let's say something happens and you couldn't track. Like the parts, they're encrypted to you. So if someone tries to put like a stolen part in a bike, it's not going to work. So doesn't mean that if you crash your motorcycle and you want to sell the parts, you can't, because you definitely can. You just like give your ownership of the part to someone else. And this is the reason why, for example, a Harley Davidson in Brazil that costs 10 times more than a Honda, the insurance is 2 times less. Because if you want a Harley Davidson, you go to the dealership to fix it. You don't go to the black market to buy the parts.
Interesting.
But the chance of you to buy a Honda and go to the black market to buy a part is much higher. So the value, so there's basically no Harley Davidsons being stolen in Brazil because the parts, they have no value on the black market. So it's very different. If you think about the problem, like discouraging the motorcycle from being stolen is the right approach, right? To reduce the theft of these bikes. And of course that you can lock it as well, right? So if you try to steal it, pretty hard. And interesting enough, I had my car stolen in Canada in December last year. And I was talking with an investor and said, yeah, this is not a problem in North America, right? Like it's hard to imagine. And the investor told me, said like, Silvio, like in my neighborhood in California, everybody that has a Land Rover, they got a Land Rover stolen.
Yeah.
I have a Land Rover. I'm just waiting for mine to be stolen as well. I'm just waiting for the day that I'll go to my driveway and it's not there. So everybody that had a Land Rover, they bought Teslas now because nobody can steal Teslas.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's interesting. And 1 week after that, my car was stolen here in Canada. So...
Theft is a big issue.
It's a problem that is growing everywhere, right?
Yeah. And so what are maybe another couple of features of the motorbike? And then I want to get back into that question and get your feedback on that.
Yeah. So like a safety is pretty big, right? Like all the safety features, they are standard in our bike, the anti-theft. Of course, electric and there's like a high torque operation. But most interesting, like for fleets, there's a huge demand, like a massive demand. We're talking of companies doing like a 70 to 80 million deliveries per month with motorcycles only. So it's like a massive market. So what we do for these companies is fleet management, the score of users, right? To see like if they are going 150 kilometers in a school zone or something like that. The fleet management and understanding of the motorcycle, the telemetry of like the state of charge, the charge infrastructure, optimization of the routes, everything else is extremely valuable for these companies. So when you see to like these two different customers, they're like the tools that we are building on the software. And again, all software based, right? So no additional cost to the user is very unique. And it's very hard to do this if you don't do everything yourself from the scratch, right? If you don't have a complete different platform than what's out there.
So you got to kind of like the Tesla approach there is, you know, just kind of build a lot of the stuff or if not everything in-house, manage it, and then you have basically a closed system.
Yes. And this is the only way that you can innovate, right, and protect yourselves. Ourselves, because like this is the other thing for investors, right? What happens if Honda comes to than an electric motorcycle, right? Honda, they own, I think that right now in Brazil is 86% of the market share is owned by Honda.
And I'm surprised because wouldn't they already have that? Honda's a very forward-thinking company. They're in the technology, right? Electrics, vehicles. Why haven't they, or where are they at? Have you seen what they're doing right now?
Yeah, I'm very familiar with what they're developing internally and other companies as well. But if you're a Honda, you need to completely change your business model, right? Because like dealerships, they don't work anymore because like they have very low maintenance. The manufacturing plants, you need to completely change it. Now the technology and suppliers, you need to disrupt that as well. So it's a complete disruption of their business model. And imagine if you go to a shareholder, stakeholder, and say like, okay, I'm going to change completely my manufacturing for electric. It will be hard, pretty hard. So they have like a very big mountain that they need to go over to move to electric, right? And we see this with the car companies as well. We see like a GM struggling and Stellantis is struggling and Ford. I think they have like a few billion dollars of losses with the F-150. It's hard to change completely your business. Of course that they are developing, right? What we are doing is trying to be ahead like several years of any company, right? And that's why you need to innovate. And you can't use the same suppliers as well, because like that could be a huge concern for investors, right? And for us as well, like if we are cut short. And I've seen this over and over.
That's great. And so let's get back to that question then. So you talked about, you know, how do we get investors on board with your vision? You talked about doubt. You talked about transparency. Is there anything else that you used or would say that helped you really get people on side with your vision?
Yeah. So you need to paint the big picture, right? What you're doing. And the most part is how can you get people excited about your vision as well, right? Because they need to have like at least a similar vision than yours. And they need to trust that your team can deliver that. I think this is the most important. So when I mean about like the transparency as well, like it's a very long relationship. It's not something that you can pitch in like half an hour and expect someone to close the deal. You need to create like this picture on the investor's mind that like how big you're going to grow and how your team can deliver that. At the early stage, the investment goes to the team basically. Like they trust, it's a trust that the team can deliver the vision. And I think that the company goes at the later and later stages, of course, that there's more validation to that and traction, right?
So I'm going to ask, going back to that, when you say the money goes to the team, here's my interpretation of that, is they are putting money into you, the team, not necessarily the business.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. And it's like you need, of course, to show them very well the business so they can see what are the weak points and the strong points of your team to deliver that, right, to achieve the end goal. But I think the major thing, at least for very early stages, is how much the team can deliver and the proof record of how the team can do it, right? So doesn't mean that you need to, that we had to be selling thousands of more cycles to show that, right? For us, what happened was we bootstrapped a long time and we built the whole technology and we built a fully functional prototype that we can show people, look, this is real. You can sit on the bike, you can ride it. And this is all the technology that we developed. Yep. We didn't need a massive team to do that because we had like in our team the knowledge and the expertise to deliver that. And I think this de-risked a lot. I think that for investors, the most important is how can you de-risk their investment as much as possible? Because as soon as you start to grow a company, labor is the most expensive component. Is where your burn will go, is where like a lot of the capital will go for labor. So if we have a team that can deliver a lot of the things without needing to hire someone externally, and showing them the big picture and showing them like the direction for them to execute, I think this is a huge plus to get like investment.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so now, I picked up on a number of things here: de-risking, painting the big picture, labor being, you know, how do you actually bring those labor costs down or show them less costs? Now you have people interested, you've gotten them on board. And the second part is, how did you actually get them to open their wallet then? So what was, you know, how do you get people from being interested, being, committed, but then saying, okay, now show me the money?
Yeah. I think it's all goes to like the sense of urgency, especially nowadays. Like if you don't show like a sense of urgency that if you don't go to the market now, if you don't have any opportunity now, like it's showing to you, if there's nothing closed, like if the window is not closing, if you don't have like the sense of urgency on investors that, okay, now is the time to invest. Because if you don't invest now, we might, like there's a window that we need to go in. Or if we invest now, we have like these customers in the pipeline that we can close. I think it's hard, right? As soon as you lose the, if you don't keep the momentum and you don't show that now is the time to invest, it's hard to convince them to invest. But they have like several other investments to do that could be more urgent than yours, right?
Yep.
So they will go on their list and say, okay, this investment is more urgent than this company. And that's when I decide to put the money now, right? And this is tricky. This is hard. Because like, how can you show like the sense of urgency, right? If you have like a customer that has a purchase order, that's a great sense of urgency that you need to deliver. If you have a deadline to achieve, or if you have like a market that is open now, or a big opportunity. So I think that this is the major thing to close, right? Is how urgent they need to invest. Because they could be extremely excited about what you're doing. But if they don't need to invest today, they will not.
That's a really good point. I like that, because it's a good old, urgency creates, creates people or gets people to make decisions. That's brilliant. I like that part. So what other suggestions would you have for CEOs out there, for founders that are looking for money, that are looking for investors? Are there any other tips that you have?
Yeah. It's hard. I think that's like, I did a lot of things in my life, and raising money wasn't like a near close on the list of the easiest things.
Where would you put that in terms of level of difficulty raising money on a scale of 1 to 10 for you?
Oh man, like that would be like close to the hardest things that I've ever done. Because it's like, and it's how you keep yourself motivated as well, receiving a lot of no's, right? Because you go with meeting after meeting and after meeting, and people, or they say no, or they say I'm thinking about, and they keep like doubting, okay, what I'm doing wrong, right? Yeah. Especially like the first time you raise. It's hard. It's pretty hard until you close the first one. And it's interesting how people work, right? Because as soon as you close and you have capital and you keep momentum, then a lot of other people, they want to jump on board because you create this sense of urgency. But to do that is hard. Like the first one is not easy. And it's like a trying to get like a warm interest. For me personally, like a cold interest didn't work well. Try to connect with people. It's all about like relationship, right? If you have someone in common that they know and they trust, to open the door for them to pay attention to what you're saying is much better than you just outreaching by email and trying to get them a meeting, right? The first time. But it's not easy. It's pretty hard.
That's tough. Yeah. But I like what you just said there again, is the warm intros. I think so many people, the cold route, it's needed at times and you have to do that, but there's so much more potential in the warm intros. And it's not necessarily, I don't want to say it's a easier process, but it's also, an accelerated process because you are using the trust of other individuals, because building that trust, I think is probably the most important thing, if not the most important thing.
Yes, I agree. I can't agree more with that.
Yeah. So I want to thank you, Silvio, because this has been a great insight in terms of what you shared with us here answering this question. I encourage everybody to go take a look at your company and take a look at what you guys are doing, because it's absolutely phenomenal. Where can people go to get to know more about your business?
So they can go to the website. It's auper.ca, so AUPER.ca. Then you can check the bike there. We're right now changing the website, but there's a lot of good stuff there.
Okay, awesome. So I encourage you to do that. If people want to get a hold of you directly, maybe there's some potential investors out there, maybe there's someone interested in your business, how can they get a hold of you?
Yeah, you can connect on LinkedIn. So Silvio Rotilli. So Silvio is Silvio, and Rotilli is Rotilli. I'm usually pretty quick in replying, by the way. So
yeah, so if anybody's interested out there, if you want to talk to Silvio, if you are thinking about investing, maybe even purchasing one, who knows?
Yes.
Take a look, reach out to Silvio on LinkedIn. We'll have his name in the show notes. Silvio, I want to thank you. Great wisdom here, and I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. If you got value from the show, we have one simple ask. Please go to your favorite podcast platform and hit subscribe. We'll see you next time.